participated in the deliberation of these cases. The court has on its docket this morning two causes. Texaco v. Central Power and Light and Byers v. Byers. We will take a short recess in between the two arguments. The arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. The council may make an application with the clerk if they want to listen to those arguments. We may proceed with the first cause, Texaco v. Central Power and Light.
May it please the court, Ms. Joyce Holloway will present arguments for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the narrow question presented by this case is whether the petitioner's conduct below constituted participation in the actual trial, as that phrase is used in Rule 45B of the Texas Rules of Appellate Procedure. Judges Chapa and Stone of the San Antonio Court of Appeals found that Texaco's conduct did constitute participation in the actual trial, and therefore that Texaco was precluded from appealing by writ of error. Accordingly, Judges Chapa and Stone dismissed Texaco's appeal for want of jurisdiction and never reached any one of the 15 points of error brought by Texaco.
Why did Texaco, I don't understand the situation. Did Texaco know that issues involving Texaco were a part of this lawsuit?
Your Honor, Texaco was served in this case by the plaintiff's petition. The Espinosa had brought suit against Texaco, and there had been a cross-claim filed by the other defendant in this case, CP&L. So you are correct in your assumption that Texaco did know that a lawsuit was pending against it.
And they knew there were going to be issues against it in this lawsuit.
Your Honor, any party that receives a petition knows that there's going to be issues presented at the trial against it. However, the appeal by writ of error rules do not require that if you have knowledge of the suit that you cannot appeal by writ of error.
Okay, I'm not there yet.
Okay.
So now you're there on the day of trial and the jury's out there ready to be picked and Texaco's lawyer's there and announces they're ready to try the case and the other parties are there. And so this case goes to trial, and what do? Just kind of forget?
Well,
just kind of walk away or just not know what was going on?
If you look at the record, you will see that Texaco did attend the pretrial discussions on the morning of trial. The meals were ready. The court recessed so that the parties' counsel could discuss the various pretrial motions in limine. Texaco then settled with the plaintiff and then did not return to the courtroom to resume discussions of the pretrial motion, and then did not, of course, return that afternoon when the jury was here. If you're asking me the question, what was going on in Texaco's lawyer's mind, I'm happy to answer that, but I would have to go outside the record to do so. In this record, there's nothing here that would illuminate to the court what Texaco's thought processes were.
At what point can a lawyer walk away from the trial of a case and claim and still be proper in claiming they didn't participate in the trial of the case?
The test under the rule as it currently exists is that you have to participate in the actual trial in order to be deprived of a right to appeal by writ of error. I think your questions go to, well, what's the state of mind of the lawyer? Is he intentionally walking away?
I'm not sure that whether the lawyer goofed or intentionally walked away makes a difference. I'm just asking you, at what point in the trial of a case could the lawyer walk away and claim that they had not participated in the trial?
I would submit that they better walk away before the trial actually begins, because if they participate in any aspect of the actual trial, as that phrase is used in Rule 45B, and then which has been defined by the lawyer's Lloyd case, they're going to be stuck and they're not going to be able to appeal by reason.
Is that before they have to walk away before the first question in voir dire or before the jury is seated in the jury box?
Well, if you're talking about an actual trial that is a jury trial, and understand, of course, that dispositions of the case can occur under all different circumstances. There could be summary disposition. Some of these cases, most writ of error cases, are, of course, default cases. But if it's a jury trial, you have to participate in some aspect of the case that occurs before the jury, because the jury is the fact finder in the case.
If it's a Rule 160, 165, at some point the judge can talk to the lawyers and determine that some issues are in dispute, some are not, and the judge can say, well, I'm going to render judgment on the issues that are not in dispute, and the jury will have to try the issues that are in dispute. And so you end up with a jury on part of the case, but not the whole case. Can the lawyer walk away after the judge has Can the lawyer walk away at any point before the jury gets picked, regardless of what the rulings are by the trial court?
If you have a judgment that's rendered partly on, I guess, a summary judgment type case, and then partly on jury findings, which of course is not our case, but I would think that if you participate in legal points or fact points that lead to the ultimate judgment, then you're going to have been found to have participated in the actual trial. In the case that is presented by our appeal, there was a jury trial, and at which point at the conclusion of the evidence, of course, certain questions were submitted to the jury, and they made findings and judgments rendered on those findings. But what you're asking, I think, is when you have kind of a hybrid, then when is the participation enough to get you out of an appeal by writ of error? And I would agree with you that if you participate in some aspect of the trial that's going to be the basis of the judgment, then you have participated. You have taken part in, you have joined in the actual trial. Here, that didn't happen. Texaco left the courtroom before the jury was even summoned.
After you announced ready?
We announced ready at a pretrial conference, that's correct.
And the bottom line is whether the announcement of ready is tantamount to participation in the trial.
I would disagree that an announcement of ready is tantamount to participation. It's almost as if you're saying, I am ready to participate, which does not mean I am participating. I think that, as I pointed out in the brief, a lot of times your announcement of ready may take place months before you actually commence trial, because in some of these counties, you have a lot of pretrial hearings, and the court then decides what day to summon the jury, and it could be weeks and months later. So we would not agree.
Is Texaco appealing any of the jury findings?
Yes.
My understanding, they're appealing the indemnity portion of the judgment.
We're of course appealing the indemnity, but in connection with appealing that indemnity, we have pointed out errors on the face of the record. In this court's opinion in DSC versus Moffitt, the court held that errors on the face of the record include not only the transcript, but errors that are apparent from the statement of facts. So we have brought forward points of error that relate to the sufficiency of the evidence to support certain jury findings. Of course, those questions were never reached by the Court of Appeals, because Judge Kaplan and Judge Stone decided that they had no jurisdiction to consider our appeal. Judge Rickhoff authored a rather lengthy dissent. We then moved for rehearing en banc, and we received two other dissents. Judge Duncan wrote a dissent in which Judge Green joined, and I've often thought about this case. If I just had a different panel, we would not have been in this position, and then the court would have reached our appeal on the merits. Before I discuss the specifics of Judge Chapman's holding, I want to raise a concern that was raised by Judge Chapman and also echoed in the respondent's brief, and that is that you are somehow better off by not participating, by walking away from the trial and then appealing by writ of error. I understand that concern, but I think when you examine the situation closely, you'll be compelled to agree that you're never better off by not participating in a trial. If you don't participate in a trial, you're not going to get an opportunity to assist in jury selection. You're not going to get an opportunity to make an opening argument. You're not going to get an opportunity to present any witnesses or to present any exhibits that would support your position in the case on the merits. You're not going to get an opportunity to cross-examine your opponent's witnesses. You're not going to get an opportunity to request the trial court to include in the charge questions that pertain to some of your affirmative defenses. You're not going to get a chance to ask the trial court to include in the charge certain instructions that would be favorable to you. All you're doing by not participating in the actual trial is ensuring that you will lose the trial. And so I can't imagine any situation where you would intentionally walk away from the trial, thinking, well, I'll just appeal this by writ of error and not participate. That just doesn't happen. And again, I think if you look at most of the writ of error cases, you'll see that they are default cases. The rule is somewhat of a safety net. I think that this court's definition of participation in the actual trial, as stated in the Lawyer's Lord case, and I have put that on the board as course, in our brief, remains a very workable definition. I think that you could give thought to changing the definition so that we're concerned with knowledge and need to know what was going on, but that would become an unworkable definition because then as soon as you received a petition or a cross claim, you have knowledge and then you would be held to participate.
Let me ask you a question, which I'm sure Ms. McManus will address. Is there an equitable component to this rule?
I think in Lawyers Lloyd that the court recognized an equitable component, and that is that a party who did not participate in the actual trial is unfamiliar with the record and therefore would need the longer time period to study the record and file an appropriate brief. In this case, there were 16 witnesses who testified during 5 days.
Well, what I have reference to is if Texaco's lawyers were negligent, they could avail themselves of the rule, or if they intentionally chose not to participate, they can avail themselves of this rule.
That's correct.
Either way, either negligence or intentional.
Judge Gonzalez, you're exactly correct.
Well, I'm asking, if there are any cases that have put a gloss on this.
The Adams versus Isbell case, which is a Dallas no writ decision, the attorney showed up, took a non-suit on his client's claims against the defendant. The trial court said, before you leave, you better know, Judge, counsel, that I'm going forward with the defendant's counterclaim. And the plaintiff's counsel walked out of the courtroom, and the Dallas Court of Appeals said that it was proper for the Dallas trial court to go ahead and hear the counterclaim, but it was also proper for the Court of Appeals to entertain the appeal by writ of error because the attorney had, and the party had not participated in the actual trial on the counterclaim.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Mr. Russell McMahon to present argument number 5. Your Honor has foreshadowed the fact that I was going to talk about an equitable component to the writ of error practice, which is actually recognized in the Lawyers Lloyd's case as part of the legislative history. Of course, prior to the writ of error rule, and still we have a couple of two lines of the statute that's now been moved into the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. The statute, the writ of error statute that is now the basic precursor of our rules, was basically enacted in 1939 and became effective in 1940. The Lawyers Lloyd case is the first case that discusses the participation issue because prior to 1940, there was no limitation on the use of a writ of error with regards to participation.
Have you been able to find any legislative history of the enactment of the initial statute?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Have you been able to find any legislative history?
Yes, there is actually a legislative purpose or declaration in terms of the no participation part that is part of the statute itself in the enactment clause that is mentioned in Lawyers Lloyd versus Webb. Section 4 of the statute, which is formerly the 2249A of the Texas Revised Civil Statutes and is still reproduced there if we have the old books. The need that delay of justice be not caused by parties who should reasonably use appeal instead of writ of error, and the near approach to the end of the session creates an emergency and an imperative public necessity and so on. So it's part of the emergency clause, enactment clause, and the Supreme Court concluded in Lawyers Lloyd, says the legislative purpose was to take away the right of appeal by writ of error from those who should reasonably use the more speedy method of appeal. So the question of whether or not someone should be expected, and it would be more reasonable to expect them to use a speedier method of appeal, is part and parcel of the history of this statutory change to limit writ of error practice as it was done in 1940, because that's what was done in the passage of this statute, was a limitation on the use of writ of error beyond that which had been utilized prior to that time, and the non-participation requirement. Now, the actual fact situation in Lawyers Lloyd versus Webb was that there was no question of no participation in that case. It was the surety that was hit on the judgment in a replevin bond. The principal had been at the trial. The surety had not. The surety had participated in the motion for new trial proceedings, and all the court says, and all of the language that they're talking about is simply saying that after the judgment, participation in those proceedings, while in common lawyer parlance, might be part of the trial, For purposes of this statute, we will say that participation post-judgment is not caused. On the other hand, there are cases since then, and since the enactment of the statute, that have held that the mere fact that the trial itself is over and prior to a judgment, if a party appears, accepts to the judgment, gives notice of appeal, even though they have not participated in any of the earlier proceedings, judgment is then entered, they are not entitled to take a writ of error. And the cases are clear on that. So it is not a question of participating in any actual adducing of evidence. The only case that they have attempted to rely on is this Adams versus Isabel case, which of course is both a no-writ case and a case in which the court reached the merits fairly easily and said, well, there's no error here anyway, so we don't have to worry about it. They did allow the appeal. That particular individual, however, merely appears to non-suit the claim. And whether or not he, again, that record appears to be silent, at least the Court of Appeals' discussion of it is silent. I've not gone to the underlying record. But there's no indication by counsel that he was prepared, authorized, or otherwise to proceed on the counterclaim. He just left. He knew that, that the trial was set that day and was informed there was a counterclaim that was going forward at that time. Did leave. Court did say, okay, we can do it this way. I don't necessarily agree that that was an appropriate decision on the part of the court. But even so, our tax situation is much more further down the road.
What did Texaco do other than announce ready?
Well, other than announce ready,
before the jury selection, before the trial?
Well, it was before the jury selection. Now, in terms of what the date of trial is a magical date for a number of things in the rules, and basically is the date the trial is scheduled to commence, and that's traditionally been the holding in this state when it deals with questions like amendments without leave for 7 days prior to trial and so on. It's the date that it's set for trial, that's when the trial begins. They did announce ready for the, and that is on the record. The judgment also recites their appearance for the trial. That judgment roll cannot be impeached in a writ of error proceeding. Now, in addition to that, it's also clear in the judgment, they appeared later on during the proceedings while the case was still in trial in order to prove up terms of the settlement. Now, not to the jury, of course, but to the judge. Nonetheless, the case is proceeding in trial. They also received notice of a judicial notice motion to take judicial notice of the tariff that was the basis for the indemnity claim and the prosecution of the cross action against them, which was Texaco's source of its indemnity claim. CPL's source of indemnity claim against Texaco. They knew that. That was served on them during the trial. All of that is reflected in the record. There was no response, no effort to do anything. Other side is correct in saying that the record does not reveal why this rather strange conduct occurred. One could only speculate, but what we can tell for sure is that the settlement papers on file reflect that there is no indemnity running in favor of the plaintiff, that is, in favor of Texaco, against the plaintiff in their settlement proposal. And so there is no reason whatsoever, nor was that ever part of the what was proved up at the time of trial, there is no reason whatsoever for Texaco to have ever assumed that their issue was not going to be tried in these proceedings. The issue had been joined specifically. They had answered and appeared to the action. They had announced ready for the trial of the entire action. And now they would suggest that they get to disrupt all the proceedings by filing 6-month writ of error because they chose to absent themselves for whatever undisclosed reason and attempt sub silentio to impeach the judgment rule, which basically the judgment itself saying that they appeared and announced ready for trial. They had appeared by in person. It's recitations in the judgment, which is not subject to impeachment in this kind of context.
So the bottom line is, it's an announcement of ready, tantamount to participation in the trial, because the settlement, of course, the approval of the settlement later on, outside the presence of the jury, should not matter.
Well, it's nonetheless a participation. It's the interesting thing that is attempting to be done here is there is some segmenting attempting to be done about stage of the trial or some identifiable place and compartment. When the trial is going on and there are things that the defendants want to do during the course of the trial, they go over there, they do them. And they do them in open court. That settlement is proved out in open court. Wouldn't be a Rule 11 agreement or a settlement if it isn't done in open court, whether the jury's there or not. Trial is going on. That is a mid-trial proceeding. That is a participation while it is in trial. And they wish to say, well, but the jury wasn't there. Jury has nothing to do with it. Neither was the jury there when people appeared personally after a trial and accepted and gave notice of appeal to a judgment. And that's all they did, didn't participate at any time. They were still held liable to have participated. The only timeline that the court sets in Lawyers Lloyd is post-judgment proceedings are not going to be held participation. And the cases have gone further in talking about defaults and summary judgments, things like that, basically says that the mere answer or a pretrial matter is not going to be. But when you are a participant in any manner in the proceedings themselves, and the suggestion is made, well, not a participant because he didn't say anything, didn't do anything, well, he announced ready, but that he didn't really do anything, didn't do anything significant. Participation has never meant that the person had to be attempting to stand up and act as an advocate, offer anything, or do anything. The mere presence was always enough.
I think that if the settlement had been proved up after the trial, then that would be fit fairly squarely within the lawyer's lawyer's case.
If that were the only thing in issue.
And if it had been, it could have been proved up before the trial, and then again, it would not have been participation in the trial.
The settlement alone, no.
And surely the motion, surely you can serve motions on absent parties during a trial, and that doesn't mean, that doesn't drag them in as participants any more than the answer.
No, but it is a motion with regards to a request to take judicial notice in the trial of the contract between them that is the basis for the indemnity claim that we had served and they had answered.
But it seems unusual that a motion would, being served with a motion would make you an actual participant when being served with a petition would not.
Well, but you aren't served with a petition during trial about the fact that there is evidence about to be introduced to you on a claim that you announced ready.
But it seems to me the disregard of that motion is all the more reason to think that they weren't participating in the trial.
And I disagree, Your Honor. I think it's not a question of whether they disregarded or that that's treated as some kind of conduct. It is merely the fact that they knew full well what was being litigated. They participated in the litigation process as it was going on.
If it had been a different kind of motion, would that... Is it the character of the motion that makes a difference?
Well, I think it is both the character and the fact that it was the essence of the complaint, in fact, against them in regards to the indemnity issue. There was no written settlement agreement produced during the trial. So the written settlement agreement that appears in the record was prepared later. We actually had no way of knowing whether or not our claim for indemnity was one to be litigated against the plaintiff, in essence, on a circuitous indemnity argument, or as against CPNF. But there's no burden that should be placed on us with regards to that, because we're not the ones who negotiated the settlement.
Following up on Judge Peck's question on the motion, Texaco argues that participation in the trial leading up to the judgment that you complain of would involve action, and that the failure to act, therefore, is not participation in trial. What's your answer to that argument?
I do not disagree that a failure to act can be characterized as participation.
But your argument is because they got the motion and did nothing, that means they were on notice of something, and then in your argument, that means participation.
No, it is relevant to the notice, and it is relevant to the issue.
How is it relevant to the definition that Lawyers Lloyd gives us on what participation in actual trial means?
Because lawyers...
The failure to act.
Well, Your Honor, it has nothing to do with the failure to act, and it's a mischaracterization to suggest that's what our argument is. Our argument is they knew the trial was going on. It was merely a component of the fact of their knowledge.
Well, but in Adams versus Isbell, that lawyer knew the trial was going to go on and was told adversely to him, and yet he left and still that court...
He never announced ready, Your Honor.
So, now that gets back to Judge Gonzalez's question. Is the bottom line the announcement of ready?
It's not just case? The announcement of ready. It is the
well,
appearance
every time
and announcement.
That question is asked, you go back to that one point. Is that the bottom line or not?
It is part of it, but the appearance and the announcement of ready for the trial, the appearance for the trial, is identified in the judgment.
Right.
Which is not subject to being attacked on right here.
So
you cannot produce an affidavit that would contradict.
Your argument is then the announcement of ready is tantamount to participation in trial under the definition from lawyer's law. Is that it?
The announcement of ready and the judgment recitation that they appeared. The appearance at trial of a party who has been sued and who is reflected in the judgment. The announcement ready is merely a further nail in the coffin in that regard. They don't have to say anything. There are cases in the writ of error practice where parties do not say anything on the record. You can't tell if they were there. And there is affidavits allowed to be supplemented by the judge to say, yes, they were there, in order to defeat a writ of error. On the other hand, they are not allowed to produce a writ of error to say that they were not there if the judgment reflects that they were, because they cannot impeach the judgment
but
on the direct appeal.
The rule doesn't talk in terms of appearance. It talks in terms of participation in the actual trial.
I understand.
So why is appearance tantamount to participation in the actual trial?
Because the entire essence of what was accomplished in the 1940 change was to say that we're not going to allow people that ought not to be allowed to be taking the slow route with regards to an appeal. We are narrowing the writ of error practice. The legislative purpose was to take away the right of appeal by writ of error from those who reasonably should we use the more speedy method of appeal. The Court of Appeals in the Noriega case, which was denied by this court last year, has a specific holding with regards to the same thing, saying that the writ of error is not, however, an appropriate avenue for relief for a party who has suffered a judgment at his own hands, nor is it an appropriate avenue for those, quote, who should reasonably use the more speedy method of appeal. And that's a case in which basically it was a dismissal for want of prosecution. They had started the reinstatement process. They had discovered it. They didn't complete it in time. And then they tried a six-month writ of error. And they said, no, you can't do that, because you should be using the procedures that are given in the rules. You knew that was going on. It doesn't matter that they didn't participate in the hearing on the dismissal for the one prosecution. They had discovered it and participated in the process, started the process, abandoned it, and the court said, can't do that. That was writ denied by this court in 94. On the same basis, which is the same basis is one that, if you will, is an equitable, not really from the notion of an equitable, it's a legal remedy. That's the problem. This is a jurisdictional concern.
If they filed a motion in limine and got a ruling on it, would that have been...
Your Honor, I think the more they participate, obviously better, but I do not think that one can segment the trial. The argument could easily be made, well, suppose I walk out during the testimony of an individual.
Well, there has
do I get to say that I didn't participate with regards to that phase of the trial and don't have to raise any objections?
The whole question in this case is, where is the lie? There has to be a lie somewhere.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, and I agree, and what I further agree and what I have argued all along is that the line is not a wavy line, because this is a jurisdictional matter. And if this court says that you can intentionally walk out of the courtroom and gain any kind of procedural advantage, and the argument is, well, we don't have any procedural advantage. Read their briefing in the Court of Appeals, their position in the Court of Appeals, and there are Court of Appeals cases, not really Supreme Court cases, but there are Court of Appeals cases suggesting that, well, you don't have to preserve any complaints, don't have to raise any evidence complaints, don't have to raise any objections to the trial. We can just make this whole stuff up, this stuff up later, after the fact. Everybody else who is abided by the rules is punished at their expense.
Well,
and they don't have to.
Why
do
wouldn't everybody take a writ of error appeal?
Well, yeah, if that were the law, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, but I can't take it. It's not. So then what procedural advantage?
Well, no, But I'm saying that is, there are Court of Appeals opinions who say that. But again, the whole point is the same. It all goes back to the same analysis. And that is that the reason why the court said you don't have to be as specific with regards to your objections, or don't have to specifically object in order to raise the issue on the writ of error, is because they say if you didn't have a reasonable opportunity to do so. And they go back to cases which basically talk about state of the lawyer's knowledge, concealment of things from the lawyer, and so on. All of which talks about things that relate to intentional conduct on the part of the lawyer that should not be condoned.
But what procedural advantage do you think they got?
Well, that is their argument, that they don't have to object or do anything. They have no objections. They have no...
But you don't think they got that?
They have no anything. I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You don't think they got that?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm saying is there are cases that do say that in connection with a writ of error that are courts of appeals cases. I'm saying that consistent with that, you can't possibly give that type of a remedy to with regards to appeal on considering the merits.
But, Maine, don't you see what the court wrote in Lawyer's Lawyer, that trial means actual trial as is ordinarily understood by the legal profession, is the hearing in open court leading to the rendition of a judgment. That's a barrier to rule the way the Court of Appeals rule and the way you're suggesting this court rule?
No, Your Honor, I don't agree.
Well, we have to...
That language is taken out of context, as I've already explained to the court, because the actual place in which that language is used is that the argument was made and the argument is admitted by the Supreme Court in Lawyer's Lawyer that ordinarily we would think participation in a motion for new trial was a participation in the actual trial. And they said, but we're going to liberally construe that a different way in this particular instance. So, but ordinarily, we would think that actual trial actually includes all of the things that relate post-trial, post-judgment. But we're going to cut it off at the judgment. And that's what the cases have done, basically. And they talked about post-judgment. And now what is attempted to do is to muddy the waters of an actual trial that was had to a jury in which these people come and they announce ready and then this proceeding takes place. And it is at their own hands, and they should not be rewarded in any way. If they have any equitable grounds or complaints whatsoever, they still have an avenue of bill of review, if they could make it. But not by writ of error, in my judgment, under the cases.
All right. Any other questions? By the counsel.
Counsel, is it important to your argument that this is a jury trial? In other words, if there had been no jury requested in the case and your client had announced ready and then walked out of the courtroom, would it be any different?
I really don't think so. It is important in this case that it is a jury trial when you're looking at the lawyer's lawyer definition of actual participation. But if Texaco has
so participation is different in a jury as opposed to a non-jury?
No, I started to answer by saying there would be no difference if this was a bench trial. We did our analysis in the brief under the jury trial, but I agree that if this was a bench trial, we announced ready. There wouldn't have been any pretrial motions, I suppose. You wouldn't have had to discuss a motion in limine, so the facts wouldn't exactly be the same. But if you announced ready, and then left before there was an opening argument or the introduction of evidence, then I don't think you would have participated in the actual trial that led to the rendition of judgment by the trial court in the bench trial.
I think what I'm struggling with is why should we allow appeal by writ of error if counsel hypothetically thumbs his or her nose at the tribunal?
Well, because the rule requires that participation is the element.
And so we shouldn't worry about anything other than the rule and the definition of participation. There should not be any consideration of
the attitude of counsel and his thought process when he's leaving.
I
think that I understand the court's concern with that. It just is... really doesn't happen. Counsel doesn't thumb their nose at the process and risk an adverse judgment to their client. But if
so, we should not assume. I mean, so we should assume every time counsel is announces ready and they leave and don't participate, that it is
there are other circumstances.
Benign neglect.
I don't want to call this benign neglect because, again, I know the thought processes of Texaco's trial counsel, but they're not in the record, and I don't think it appropriate for me to get into.
We're talking about a rule that would apply to inadvertence, a rule that would apply to thumbing one nose at the tribunal. You're saying the rule that you would have us adopt would apply across the spectrum to all those cases.
And there are two cases, the Specia versus Specia case and the Allen versus Allen case, where counsel was actually present during the entire trial proceeding and still was held not to participate. And so the rule has applied in those cases as well. And that goes to Mr. McMahon's argument that the appearance is sometimes tantamount to participation. In those two cases, the court clearly found that presence, which I think is an aspect of appearance, was not participation under the meaning of Rule 45D. But I think the rule is applied no matter what the thought process, the state of mind of the counsel. That's correct.
And you're saying that's a good way to interpret the rule?
Well, I think that if the court wanted to, they could make that a different element when the next time they got around to rewriting this rule. I know that this rule is up for consideration, whether the rule should remain on the books or not. I think the rule as it is presently written and is illuminated by the lawyer's lawyer case is a workable rule, and I think it's a good rule. And I don't think we need to get into what was the state of mind.
That's my question, I guess. Why is it a good rule to allow counsel to announce ready and to thumb their nose at the tribunal and allow appeal by writ of error? Why is that good for the judicial system? Why is that good for the legal system?
Well, I guess I don't think it's good for counsel to never behave in a professional manner, and I think a counsel who thumbed their nose is not behaving in a professional manner. But the risks that that counsel faces are enormous. There is no advantage that is gained by doing that. You're going to lose the trial, and by having a poor record, chances are you're going to lose the appeal. So it's not a question of whether you're giving advantages to the counsel. You're just allowing the party to pursue this different method of appeal without giving that party any procedural or other type advantages.
You don't necessarily lose the trial. CP&L had as much interest in not losing to the plaintiff as Texaco did, and CP&L picks up the tab for trying the case, and it just so happens in this case CP&L loses, and so now Texaco has the advantage of writ of error for which they don't have to preserve any of the error in the trial court.
Well, you're correct that if CP&L had won the case, Texaco settled with the plaintiff, so Texaco got out
right.
on its own volition. But Texaco, by not participating, is surely going to lose the cross-claim action. If you're correct.
But only if the main defendant in the case, CP&L, lost to the plaintiff,
mm-hmm.
right? And CP&L was going to carry the ball for doing that, right?
To protect its position because it had been directly sued.
Let's go back to this appearance. Is it your position that if I sit through the entire trial of the case but don't open my mouth once, that that's not, I have not participated in the trial?
Under the existing case law, that's my position.
I can
because if you're present, because presence is not in the rule, participation.
So in other words, you can have...
I'm talking about presence alone.
I understand. What you're saying is that Texaco could have sit mute at the counsel table, and the trial goes on for several months, and then there's a judgment, and then they come in through this process of writ of error and undo that multiple-month jury trial simply because of an intentional choice made by Texas counsel to stand mute and not ask any questions during the proceeding. Is that what you're asking us to do? I mean,
well,
that could be the effect, would it not? Am I wrong in my hypothetical?
In your hypothetical, which is not our case,
I understand.
That would be the result. But you're assuming that the trial could be undone. If Texas
well, that's your ultimate goal, isn't it? You want the Court of
Appeals.
You want the Court of Appeals to review the sufficiency of the evidence points and other legal points that you've raised,
mm-hmm.
with the ultimate goal of another jury trial between a dispute between you and Texaco, CP&L and Texaco.
That's correct, Your Honor. But we would submit that, again, the rule says participation. Here, Texaco was not present. Even if the court was going to say that participation is somehow the equivalent of presence or appearance, we were not even present during this jury trial. And the fact that we received a motion to take judicial notice and didn't do anything about it certainly doesn't amount to participation. In fact, it proves the opposite. And you cannot stack repeated lack of participation and somehow make it equal participation.
What are the two cases that you have that say that sitting through the trial is not participation?
They're cited in our brief. It's Fisher versus Fisher. I may be pronouncing it incorrectly. And Allen versus Allen. I don't recall the writ history right off.
If we accept that as the rule in any subrogation case where there's parties litigating and they've both been represented by insurance company or paid by insurance companies and now they're trying to resolve the dispute between the two of them, the insurance companies file their claim for subrogation. In any of those cases where the insurance company comes forward, asserts its claim for subrogation and allows the lead counsel to handle it, and they walk away from the trial of the case, in any of those cases, the insurance company has not participated in the trial of the case, and they can bring a writ of error later on.
If they had absolutely no participation
in the argument being that their representative sits there in the trial, but they take no action at all whatsoever during the case.
Well, if they have an agreement with the other counsel that the other counsel will prosecute their position, then I think that is tantamount to participation. I can't say I'm going to let my co-counsel do everything and then say, well, I didn't participate because I second chaired. I wasn't.
You're out of court agreement with a co-defendant that they would defend your position is participation.
If you would agree that the co-defendant would, if that was the agreement on the
How
record.
How is that participation, though, an out-of-court agreement?
No, if you had agreed on the record, I said before the court, that both of you were being represented. Sometimes you have two parties who are represented by
but
one
But how is that
counsel.
Any different from the settlement that was announced on the record here? If that's not participation, why would an agreement with co-counsel that they would defend your position
Well, I think that if you have, if you're a party to a lawsuit and you agree that you will be, your lawyer in that case is your co-defendant's lawyer as well, then you participated through that lawyer. Whereas here, all that happened in connection with the settlement was during a recess, Texaco came back to the courtroom and told the court the broad terms of the settlement with the plaintiff. I think that's kind of apples and oranges. I would also respectfully disagree with Mr. McMahon that the terms of the settlement are in the court's record. The settlement agreement is not on file. We've heard settlement agreement between Texaco and the plaintiff. It is not on file in this case. All that was done during the recess was the broad terms of that settlement was announced, and Mr. McMahon's inference that Texaco did not think it had an indemnity from the plaintiff is not supported by the record. It is just speculation.
That settlement announcement was a hearing before the judge. Doesn't the judge accept the settlement?
It was a hearing before the judge, and Mr. McMahon is right that it occurred during the trial. But lawyers
I mean, out of the presence of the jury, but that's proper that it would be out of the presence.
That's exactly right. You would never announce the terms of the settlement before the jury.
Any further questions? Take a short recess.
Thank you.